meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Thursday, May 19th, 2011. And the first thing that we have up on our agenda is a disaster relief bill, and Senator Langseth will be presenting it.
Well, Madam Chair, members, unfortunately, this is the third time in 3 years that we've come with this legislation. We're getting rather weary up there, but the good news is that because of the money the state of Minnesota and the local have spent since the 2009 flood, we were much better shaped to handle it than before. There was just far fewer sandbags used this time than there was before, so we're getting there, and everybody is very, very appreciative of what the state of Minnesota has done to help. But this does pick up the costs of the, I don't know, what do you call it, the disaster and the recovery. And it's, I guess, just under $20 million. $5 million is state. And so the bill calls for $5 million. Federal government will be coming up with $15 million. So that's basically it. Just to give you a little idea, some people have wondered why we haven't made progress. I was reading a Clay County Historical Society report of the 1952 flood. The crest was 34 feet, which was 7 feet below what it was in 2009, and 4,000 people in Fargo-Moorhead were evacuated. This year, nobody was evacuated, and it was considerably higher. So we've made a lot of progress. In Moorhead, for example, they've taken out over 100 houses the last 2 years, built many dikes, and are in much, much better shape to handle a disaster than before. We still got a ways to go, but that isn't in this bill. That would be in another bill that deals with funding. So that's basically it. And the you've got, let's see, they don't have the... Yeah, there's the two pages. Those are the 20 counties. Now, the second page of what you got, I don't believe has the detail that just sort of came in. Now I have it here if anybody wants to take a look at it. But these first two columns are that is money that has already been paid out. The rest is money that will be paid out as the cleanup progresses. So as you can see, let's see, it'd be about 3.25. About $9 million has already been paid out. So, any questions of the committee?
Members, do you have any questions? Ms. Heidi, do you want to come up? I have a few questions you might help us with. The ones on the last page here, additional 14 counties, are those ones that may come in yet, or is this pretty comprehensive that we'll only be dealing with $5 million for this spring's flood?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Chris Idy. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And yesterday we did ask for those additional 14 counties, 13 counties actually, and the Red Lake Reservation to be added to this disaster. So we are anticipating that FEMA will be approving that hopefully this week, tomorrow, or very, very soon. But all of these, all the additional 14 entities did meet their threshold to be added to this major disaster declaration.
So, Ms. Sadie, on the bottom of this sheet, we have $2.7 million. So are you expecting, that's where you came up with the $5 million, if we add in the rest of these?
That's correct, Madam Chair. This will come to just under $20 million for total damage and costs. So 25% of that, which is the non-federal share, would be right around the $5 million mark.
Now, if the federal government doesn't accept these, in the past, would all of these have been accepted?
Madam Chair, they would be accepted. Once we get our declaration, if they do meet their $3.37 threshold per capita for their population, then they are approved.
Okay. You know, members, I guess maybe we could have Senate Council for Public Safety come up. There is some history here that's kind of interesting about when we've started paying 100% of the local share. And this is something that this committee should really talk about. Chris, yeah, Mr. Turner, talk about a little bit. I don't know that we're ready to change that right now, but it used to be, and I'll let Mr. Turner explain some of the history of when it changed over where we started paying the full local share.
Mr. Turner. Madam Chair and members, Chris Idy would probably be in a better position to give the history, but briefly, it's been the unofficial policy of the state of Minnesota that the non-federal share of the 25% is split 15% state and 10% local. In recent years, the riders have been written where the state would pick up the entire 25%. I believe in 2007, I know in 2009 that was the case because the deficiency bill that we're carrying this year, we're mandated to pay the 25% because the rider language from the 2009 disaster bill is what obtained with the money. But as I said, I think that Chris Idy would probably be a better source for the history.
Ms. Idy.
Madam Chair and members, the agreement that that we sign with FEMA is that that the non-federal share will be picked up by state or local or a combination of both. And in the past, we have picked up the 15% and the local share has been 10%. But starting in 1993, the great Mississippi flood that went all the way down through through St. Louis, the state picked up the full non-federal share. Again in 1997, which was the Red River Valley flood of record, was we picked up the full non-federal share at the state. Then starting in 1997, with the bridge collapse and with the severe storms down in southeast Minnesota, the state has been picking up the full 25% share. And some of that is because with the cascading events and the time period between disasters has been so compressed, and in addition to the financial situation of local government, it was decided that the state would pick up the full 25% share.
Madam Chair, in talking to Governor Plenty, he had mentioned that was in the 2009 flood and the 2010 flood. He said right away that he thought we should pick up the local share.
And these really big disasters, I can understand that because they may not even have the property tax base to tax to get their local share. I was just talking to our staff here, and maybe not on this one, but sometimes I think that there may be a better way to do it. You know, you look at this sheet, and Traverse County, for example, which only has 4,100 people in the whole county, their local share would be very high per capita. And in some bigger disasters, it would be enormous. They would have a very hard time picking it up. But in some counties, it's much, much less. And I would think that maybe in the future, we could think of how to develop a formula that would determine when local units of government should pick up some of their share and when we would determine that that would create too large of a hardship on them. Because, quite frankly, the state doesn't have money either. And so I think I'm directing staff. I'm asking staff if they'll look at some different formulas. And I don't know if members want any input on that, on how we might deal with it. Because remember, in the past, it was 15% state, 10% local until 93. And so it could become an issue as we keep seeing these disasters occur, which we certainly have. And I just want to make sure that we aren't overburdening ourselves. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So the history is by statute then we went to 25%. Is that right?
No, I think it was handled one disaster at a time, actually. And in 93, which was a pretty big disaster, it was decided that the state would pick it up.
Yeah, the one in southeastern Minnesota, that was picked up totally, or 25% by the state. But, you know, that the communities, not so much as last year, but these communities have gone went through so much. And in 2009, they shut down the three college campuses in Fargo-Moorhead for 3 weeks, and 20,000 students were helping Dyke. And then there was some evacuation that particular year, too. So it's a major disruption by the communities themselves. So, and it's been very much appreciated that the state has come to the aid of those communities.
A person can always look upon this as local government aid. It is, because the federal requires a 25% local government match. Sometimes we're considered that local government, too, though. Senator Vana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder if there couldn't be a formula so that it wasn't subjective for, you know, the will of the particular legislature, depending on the members and the various things. I mean, I certainly agree with Senator Langseth and think this makes sense, but perhaps there could be a formula where the burden would be looked at on a per capita basis, and if at some level, you know, there would be various cut points where it would be this percentage, and, you know, a ratio could be established so that it wouldn't be up in the air.
Right. Either per capita or
and property
tax valuations.
Yeah, exactly, a combination of that.
Right. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. Question to Chris Eide. If a tornado comes through, what has been the state match versus local match on that from FEMA? Can you tell me that?
Ms. Eide.
The history and where we are now?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, last year in the summer tornadoes, the state picked up the 25% non-federal share.
And
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And that's no matter where in Minnesota?
That was no matter where in Minnesota.
So if there were to be a tornado in a very highly populated area like a suburb of the Twin Cities, the state would pick up a very large bill.
Exciting.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator Ingebrigtsen, if the cost of a disaster is based on non-insured, Minnesota has a very high homeowners insurance rate. So that's why we do have very few major disaster declarations that are tornado-based. Until Wadena happened, the last tornado that actually qualified for a major disaster was in 1998 with Comfrey and St. Peter. So if a tornado hit in a large, densely populated area, and there was a low insurance rate, then it would be a larger bill depending on the amount of damage that was done.
So,
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
So, Madam Chair, that would be a more than a fair share of local government aid, then, wouldn't it?
Ms. Heidi.
Just a comment.
Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, and I think if it goes Senator over Langseth. A certain amount per capita, then it's 90-10 federal. And it's a little bit upsetting to us that North Dakota, of course, has far fewer, about one-eighth as many people as we do. We share the same disaster, and much of the time they get 90-10, and we get 75-25. And that 97 flood, we managed to maneuver things in a way that we got the 90-10, and that was a much, much bigger disaster, many, many times what this was. But it does go as high as 90-10 federal. So if you come up with a real major disaster in a large community, then it probably would hit the 90-10.
Except if it's per capita, it's harder to reach that, I suppose.
Well, the per capita is based upon the state population and so on, not just the communities. And that's one of the reasons North Dakota usually gets the 90-10, because, they, like I said, they got one-eighth as many people as we do. But it's the same flood. Mm-hmm. In fact, the North Dakota side of the river valley got more people than the Minnesota side.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to make sure I understood something that was said. What I understood you to say is that the costs are associated to reflect the lack of insured loss. So in other words, if you have a community that has a high rate of insurance, then there is virtually no loss that would be called a disaster. My problem with this is that why get insurance? If the state's going to pay the costs, why get insurance? If you get declared a disaster, if you don't have insurance, aren't we inducing the moral hazard of encouraging people not to bother? Maybe we ought to have a formula that reflects if you have a low rate of insurance, you have a higher local share to pay. I think there should be an incentive to make sure that people insure themselves against loss rather than say, well, if you don't, it gets declared a disaster and somebody else pays.
This is just public damage. If it comes to a house or something, there's...
And Madam Chair, and that's what why I wanted a clarification, because I understood you to say that it's related to insured loss. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, it is. However, a lot of roads aren't insured. A lot of park land is not insured. So that's where we get the uninsured in floods. When it hits individual families, it is a lot harder to get a declaration for individual families.
Madam Chair and Ms. Heidi, are the things you mentioned, parks and so forth, roads, are those uninsurable?
Ms. Heidi.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I don't know. I know that public buildings are insurable. I don't know about roads.
Madam Chair, I would doubt very much if roads are insurable, but and the cost probably would be kind of horrendous too. I don't know. I've never heard.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, I've never heard of roads being insurable, but I suppose somebody would be willing to take the premium and insure them.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Carlson could answer that question if you want to recognize him.
He's back there.
Probably wants the business.
But Ms. Heidi, then, so when it is public buildings and they are insured, do we cover their deductibles and things like that? So, I mean, that could be a factor. They could get lower premiums if they have higher deductibles, and then we would be paying for that later on. I don't know if there's any standard at all for municipalities and counties.
Madam Chair and members, the FEMA is very highly encouraging communities to have appropriate insurance coverage for their buildings. They do pay the deductible. They do pay replacement costs. So everything that's over their insurance coverage is paid by the federal government.
Well, Madam Chair, the Wadena School, I think they were pretty much able to replace that with what their insurance was in school. I think schools tend to be, quite heavily insured.
Are there any other questions? Senator Langsa?
Madam Chair, I move that, I can't even remember what the number is.
1428.
I move that 1428 be sent to the floor.
Senator Langsa moves that 1428 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will proceed to general orders.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson. No, Senator Carlson has our next bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Maybe the insurance man here that we could find out. Why haven't you figured out how to insure roads and bridges and ditches and culverts and signs? I can't believe it.
Senator Carlson, have you ever written a policy for one of those?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Ingebrigtsen, everything's insurable.
That's what I thought.
It's a matter of willing to pay the cost. And a lot of those things that you talk about, however, aren't insurable through normal kinds of channels. But everything is insurable.
Welcome, sir.
I'll let it go at that.
As in the tradition of.
Senator Carlson has Senate File 1340. It's called the Magic Act.
the Magic Act.
It intrigues us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for getting us in on this tight schedule. This is probably our last shot at. We're hoping for a photo finish on this bill. Senate File 1340, we call it the Magic Act. It stands for the Minnesota Accountable Government Innovation and Collaboration Act. And members, what this is essentially is a culmination of many years of some really high-level thinking at the county level, many good thoughts and processes going on at the county level, many good our delivery service of all of our state services at the county level. Those people are our boots on the ground. And they really do come up with some innovative ideas and ways of delivering services and delivering them in a way that makes more sense for their specific geographic region. And I think probably without my going on any further, Joe Matthews from the Association of Minnesota Counties is here, and I'm going to let Joe kind of describe the nuts and bolts of the bill.
Mr. Matthews, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'll give you the brief summation since it's been a long day for everyone. The bill has two acts. The first act is basically allowing counties to be full-fledged local governments. You may or may not know, under current law, counties only allowed to take action that's explicitly authorized by state law, which means if we find something new or a new way to serve our community, we can't do that without first coming to the state for authority to take that action. Article 1, we had some assistance from the National Rifle Association and others to refine the language, but essentially it says if no other local government, the state government, or the federal government has spoken to an issue, then the county would be authorized to act on behalf of its community. It's not something that we think is going to be a huge move forward. It's not going to kick the barn doors open for counties to run wild, but it will allow us to step into places where there might be a vacuum and there might be a need within the community to help with that. The second act is really the bulk of the bill, and what it does is it authorizes a waiver process where counties with an idea for how to better deliver services can actually work with the state agencies to refine a business model and put it in place for a period of up to 36 months. Our intent then with the language is to bring it back before the legislature to show you real results in the field of what happened, whether it worked or whether it didn't work, and then allow the legislature to determine whether or not that could be established as a best practice or a permanent business model going forward. So again, our intent here is to actually take some ideas that we have locally with various counties, put those into practice with agency supervision for a limited period of time, and then bring it back before this body and others, the House as well, to get your input and feedback. There's also a reporting mechanism that we will report each December, and that will be provided to the legislature in January to ensure that you have a up-to-date list of what's happening and what's going on, and obviously you'll retain the authority as the legislature to review those at any time in addition to their conclusion at the appointed time. And, Madam Chair, that's a brief description. There's a small fiscal note of $228,000, which is obviously why we're here. We've been in ongoing discussions with MMB and DHS for the last week and a half, and at this point, we're asking them to absorb the cost. However, as we go forward, MMB has agreed to continue talking with us to make sure that their concerns are addressed as far as how this will be implemented, and I think looking at the process side of things. But we are asking them to absorb those costs, and we are continuing to talk with them to make sure their concerns are addressed. I think there is someone here from DHS. Both agencies have been very supportive of the policy, and I think they want to see this continue to move forward. They are concerned, obviously, of their ability to absorb these costs given the current fiscal climate. However, again, they've been very supportive of the policy, and so we're continuing to try and come to some resolution on that.
Mr. Matthews. Maybe Mr. Gustafson, do you want to just members pick up and grab your fiscal note here, and we'll just go through it quickly and see where the expenses are.
Madam Chair, members, the fiscal note in your packet does lay out costs. This fiscal note was reviewed by I think 9 different agencies, and the costs are being noted by Minnesota Management and Budget and Department of Human Services. The bill requires that to implement the act that the governor appoint a coordinator, and that coordinator in the fiscal note is assumed to be at MMB. And so I think that's the most clear, direct requirement from the bill for a position, and that's obviously a notable cost. DHS has also identified the need for a staff position And MMB, I'm sorry, also added a half a support position. So there's 2.5 FTEs envisioned necessary to carry out the functions of the bill, and that's the what drives the cost. It's a staffing cost related to implementing the requirements of the bill. The other agencies that responded note that they're likely to participate in some way, but there's not a direct effect to their operation that they're noting a cost, but they'd likely be participants depending on the nature of the projects that would be implemented under this bill.
Questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I haven't gotten through all of the Senator Carlson, how many it talks about a pilot project and a county may apply. Is there a limitation on the number of counties? And could you tell me how many that is? I haven't crossed that in the bill yet.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Olson. The maximum number is 2 per county, 10 per agency. So, in other words, if more than 20 counties wanted to do some kind of a project with Health and Human Services, they would only be able to take up to 20.
Not 10.
Up to 10. And a county would not be able to do more than 2 different kinds of pilot projects. So it's a very narrow scope to start with to see how this is going to work.
So, Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, it's not a county looking at a broad scope of service delivery. They're zeroing in on one dimension. And so you said 20 counties could participate. No, if a county had 2, it would be limited to 10 counties. It depends on whether, but you're looking at 20 projects?
Madam Chair, if I could. The bill allows each agency, or only requires each agency to allow up to 10 pilot projects, and each county may only participate in 2. The idea was to make sure that we don't have counties trying to go out with too many things at once. We also didn't want to overload the state agencies with a huge number of pilot projects. So as far as what we actually expect to see happen, we only believe, especially in the area where human services, since that's where the fiscal note is on the agency side, we think there's only a handful of counties with the sophistication to really put together a human services pilot project. But there will be others who work with, say, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, or they might work with DNR or others. And those agencies, I think, are expecting that they can do that within the available resources. So I think as far as what we see, we're positing that we think we'll see maybe 1 or 2 pilot projects in human services in the first year. It'll take a while to draft up those plans. Maybe we'll see 3 or 4 by the end of the biennium is what we're expecting as far as a realistic projection. Other agencies, we expect to see more.
So, Madam Chair, and I missed your name.
Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota
Mr. Matthews. Where did I see that DHS, there's an assumption being made that would assume that they'd need a coordinator, even if there were, like, 2 projects that were in DHS? Or what's the basis for determining they need to have that kind of level of staffing when you don't know who would apply for what?
Madam Chair, Senator, there is someone from DHS here who can speak in greater detail, but I believe the concern or the difficulty for nailing down the number for DHS is, given the birth of services, if it's something really complex, it may take more time. If it's something simple around a grant or a specific process, it may take not so much. And
welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Ralph McCorder with the Minnesota Department of Human Services and members. The bill speaks to allowing up to 10 pilot projects. So given that the nature of that, we had to make the assumption that we've had different counties express interest over time. There's already in law Chapter 402A with the Development of Service Delivery Authority. So in some of those conversations, we know that there are counties who are interested. For us, the issue is the scope of each individual project. And with Senator Hannah's left, but given human services, we have such a wide range, it's not clear whether an individual county might be interested in doing something with Minnesota Care, which is very complex and how it provides benefits to its citizens. or something very small like an individual grant program. So for us, we erred on saying we need a person in our agency who will be able to work with up to 10 different counties on a wide range of activities and not knowing the scope of any one project.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Is it Mr. Recorder?
Yes.
How many do all of our counties each have their own independent division in dealing with the DHS issues and services? Are there any of them that have coordinated or combined efforts in those areas?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Recorder.
There are just a handful of counties that have come together for the delivery of human services. And so there are five counties that each have their own. There's two different areas specifically where they've joined together. There are various projects around the state that are involved in, I'll call it regional activity, but not at the whole scale county level for human services.
And Madam Chair, do you, Mr. Recorder, do you anticipate that any of those that are in a combined mode might, that might be a way of conserving resources, but would they have a benefit from the pilot, participating in a pilot as a combined entity?
Mr. Recorder.
Madam Chair, at this point there are 84 county human service entities in the state, so it's not clear how they will approach us on these projects.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Carlson, there's nothing in the bill that would prohibit municipalities and counties from combining efforts, is there?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, most of the questions have been on Article 2, but I do have a question on Article 1. And it's the authorization to take over more responsibilities without having to come back to the legislature to get that responsibility. And I'm looking at the thing that Senate Counsel writes for us, and there's a reference in here saying the authority is subject to current law on firearms regulation. And yet I don't see any reference to firearm regulation in Article 1. So I'm wondering what's in here that I can't read to make that leap.
Madam Chair, I would like to defer that to Mr. Bodden. I think he could probably give us the best explanation.
Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I think that's a reference to line 1.22 of the bill. I've got to look up section 471.633, but that deals with local regulation.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Matthews.
If I could, Senator Higgins. There was a concern raised by the National Rifle Association that this section might be construed so as to imply that counties had the authority to supersede state or federal gun regulation. And so the cross-reference is specifically citing state statute that the state is retaining that authority and that is not being handed down to the counties. And I think Mr. Bodden's got the statute if you want the actual quote, but that's where that came
enough.
From.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I remember years ago talking to I guess he's now a former Hennepin County Commissioner, and he was talking about something like this, you know, because counties have authority there's kind of two ways that they can have authority. It's either it's all authority that the state law doesn't forbid, or only the authority that the state law gives, and he talked about how we should switch it from what we have now to the other way, which is kind of what this is doing. It's saying that the counties can go off and do things without always having to come back here and get permission to do them. And it's funny that I would remember a conversation from 20 years ago, 15 years ago probably, but it just kind of triggered that memory. And that county commissioner now works for AMC, so I guess I'm not surprised to see it. So.
Well, and it is interesting because counties have always been considered a creation of the state, and they still are, but we are giving them expanded authority here that if we don't explicitly direct them, they can take on some responsibilities or programs or projects of their own. And I hopefully, you know, sometimes we think things can be done less expensively locally, mm-hmm. but hopefully counties won't get too carried away with this and expand too many programs. But then their taxpayers will speak up and oust their county commissioners, I suppose.
Yeah, so. And Madam Chair, you know, it seems like the unit of government that's closest to the citizens tends to be more nimble. You know, we're only here part of a year. The county commissioners are always around. You know, the city councils are always around. And I think we see a lot of good regulations that come at those local levels because they've had more time to deal with them, because they don't have to think about, you know, we're going home for 6 months, you know, come May 23rd. So they are more capable of tackling some issues that, you know, some people might say should belong here at the legislature. But the fact of the matter is, if you want to get them done, you get done at the county.
Senator Newman, did you have a question?
I did not, Madam Chair.
Okay, Senator Goodwin.
I just have a quick question. Besides the gun laws being the same for the counties as they are for the state and staying that way, are there any other laws or I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see everything, but I just want to know, is there any way that a county can get out of any other current laws, or can they just not have to come for permission for laws that aren't on the books? Is that basically what this is?
Mr. Matthews.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, you're correct. The language is very tightly drafted so that we cannot take any action that is in any area where the state or federal government has acted. So okay. We can't be inconsistent or in conflict with existing laws and rules.
That's good. Thank you.
Do the counties have a list of things that they might like to do? I'm kind of wondering what spurred it.
Senator, this has been a long conversation, Madam Chair. And in fact, the Dillon rule is what the current philosophy is called, that goes back to the 1800s, and there was a court case in Iowa, and that just kind of by default is how some states landed where we're at today in Minnesota. But one idea that has come up actually came out of Beltrami County, which is where Senator Carlson represents, and it actually, there's a initiative called Students First, where the county, the community, and some of the other local, I think the schools involved, are working on a project where they're trying to provide mentors to high school students to boost graduation rates, with the belief, they believe, they'll be able to demonstrate that a higher graduation rate will actually reduce demands on public safety, human services, some of the other programs. And so not only will they have more productive citizens, they'll actually have less demand on their services. Right now that's funded by a foundation, but when it expires, the county's not clear that they have the authority to continue that. And so if it is successful, that's something where they'd like to be able to carry their end of the stick for the small percentage that they would be funding on that. So that's one example where they might step in or they would otherwise have to come back here for enabling legislation for something like that.
So, Mr. Matthews, would that then fall under the Department of Education or the Department of Human Services? Where would that be assigned to as one of the?
Well, Madam Chair, sorry. That would actually fall under Article 1. That would be something they would just be allowed to, they'd be authorized to do, because the state doesn't speak to a Students First program. If you're looking at for a specific pilot project, one of the most ambitious ones that we've heard of that would potentially use the waivers, was that your question? The most ambitious one we've heard of has actually come out of Todd County and Crow Wing County, who are looking at developing a strategy to combat multi-generational poverty. They don't anticipate having that business plan ready for probably another year and a half at the earliest, because it's so complex. But what they're interested in doing is trying to find a way to look at all of the services that some of their families use and then see if there's a better way to provide those resources to them in order to get them out of a cycle of generational poverty. That's probably the most ambitious one that we've heard of. I think what's more likely to occur is we have, in Beltrami County, again, their administrator, Tony Murphy, believes that there's a handful of procedural things they do with Department of Human Services, and they've been able to work with some very innovative people within DHS to try and find some workarounds for some of the current statutory procedures, and I think they're looking at just doing some administrative streamlining on that. So that's probably what we'll see first. But on the spectrum of simple to complex, as Mr. McCorder referenced, that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
One example, Madam Chair, if I might, I know in Beltrami County, one of the things that they talk about is the frustration of being mandated to spend the maintenance of effort, if you will, on things like chemical dependency. And so they have to all this busy work, all the paperwork, to make sure that they've spent enough money in the chemical dependency area. and no one ever comes back and asks them, did anyone get cured? You know, what's the result of spending all this money? No one's asking them that. And so the whole point is, how do we create better outcomes with probably less inputs and a more creative way to do it? And it's not going to look the same in Beltrami as it will look in Hennepin. But yet, the hope of the pilot project is that a county or a collaboration of counties can come up with a pilot project, have some success, and then create some new best practices that another county or collection of counties, collaboration of counties, can look at and say, you know, I like that, and that could work here maybe with a little tweak in our geographic area. And so I think that's the whole idea of how do we get to a better place of delivering services to our citizens in a more efficient and effective manner.
I'm just wondering, it sounds like most of this work is going to be done at the county level, but when they seek a waiver, then is that why we're asking for a state coordinator? I am a little puzzled about having a full-time state coordinator, especially when we're starting up. We put them in place and maybe only 10 projects a year come in, and there that person is with not much work to do. And so I'm just trying to figure out if there really is a need to immediately hire a state coordinator for this and what their role would be.
Madam Chair, if I could, that's exactly the ongoing discussion we're having right now with MMB and DHS, I think, is to get a better understanding of exactly what we'll see on the ground, especially during this first biennium, to try and refine those costs. I think that the intent of having a coordinator designated, it was our intent that it could potentially be existing staff and wouldn't have to be someone new. We're not arguing with the fiscal note. I don't want to, imply anything there. But I think that as we go forward, we wanted to have one person as the point person to make sure that the number, no counties were doing three pilots and no agency was being asked to do 11. It was just to kind of have a focal point within the executive branch to understand what was going on and also to be accountable, frankly, to make sure that there was some tracking of all that. So that was the intent behind that. But again, our intent is to really minimize the amount of work at the state level.
Senator Bonna.
Madam Chair, I concur with your assessment of that. I think it's important as we do these innovative things, and I love this bill and think we ought to go forward with it, that then we don't make the same mistakes that we've made in the past where then we add bureaucracy to what we want to be a more freewheeling and, autonomous solution. So I think that we tend to go back to the way we've always done it, which is, okay, have one person, perhaps that's not the best way. So I would suggest that we push back on that and say you're not looking for a new staff member as of yet and let the demand dictate the staff need.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just reflecting that would there be any possibility even within the current assignments and roles within the Association of Minnesota Counties to have someone that actually it seemed to me that a linkage that would know what's going on in terms of these projects, that the county people would feel free to discuss with you and what their experience is, but also kind of be a liaison to the agency and not rather than have it a government entity, but just an oversight, a coordination, or a communication vehicle that might fit in within the function of one of your current staff.
And Madam Chair, to that question, our intent is to actually have the counties, and obviously AMC will be heavily involved in this, carry as much weight as we possibly can. I think at the end of the day, the administration does need to have one person. We're not expecting to have a huge workload for them, but someone needs to be, whether in name or duty, needs to be there to receive the information on behalf of the administration, which is, I believe, why we drafted it the way we did.
So, and Madam Senator Chair, I would think somebody in the Department of Administration might be a good one for that. Or maybe I'm
Mr. McCorder.
Madam Chair, I know I'm going to sound like a state bureaucrat when I say this. I just know that. But given some of the proposals can be complex, and we do have to assure that we're meeting our federal state plans, for example. So given the other level of reductions that we're seeing be proposed this session, both in the Health and Human Services bill and the state GovOp bill, I would advise that if you want a dedicated resource to carry out the support of these pilot projects, that we need a staffing effort to be able to do that. And that would be my request.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm ready to come up with the full amount here, but I would almost, not sure.
Madam Chair.
Because it's so new, we don't know how busy they would be with these proposals. I'd hate to have somebody sitting there and have two come in. I don't know how well the counties will respond to this. So, but maybe this coordinator could encourage it too. I mean, it sounds like a great idea. It could allow for innovation in the counties, but I'm puzzling over this funding issue. Mr. Matthews.
And Madam Chair, again, we are in very intensive conversation with MMB over how the agencies will completely implement this. And as Mr. McCorder referenced, there is some question as we try and get a handle on how heavily utilized this will be as to how much work there will be to do it. The statute doesn't mandate that someone be hired. I have to find the language, but I believe we said that it could be designated as somebody on existing staff. It's a member of the governor's staff or state agency. It doesn't specify that they do have to hire someone. Our initial hope was that they'd be able to find somebody within the agency or the governor's office that could just pick up those duties. But,
And Mr. Matthews, since it is so new, I would think that might be the best route to follow and then come back next year and tell us if this person, if there really is a demand for a full-time position and we need to find some funding for that, because it seems a little premature to put them in place already, especially looking at our funding issues. But I understand how this could save money locally, especially if they're collaborating and merging some county programming. So we don't want to discourage that. We want to encourage it. But at the same time, we don't want to waste any resources here either. Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I guess it is our wish that at the present time that the agencies would absorb those costs for now to get started, with the idea that if there's a demonstrated need within our projects that just exactly what you said, that we would go forward. But it's our intention to not deal with a fiscal note, that the agencies would absorb whatever costs initially.
Did I see another hand up over here? Senator Kinderbertson?
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification. So we're giving the counties the authority to do this, correct? Is that right?
Correct.
So I guess the pilot projects, Madam Chair, the supervision of the pilot project would be where the state would do the oversight then, is that right? Or why wouldn't we? I'm not quite tracking with this. Why would we not have county? We can have a county pilot project. Why wouldn't the counties do the supervision?
Mr. Recorder.
Madam Chair, as I read the language, it would require each state agency who has projects before them to provide the development of the process, the forms, procedures, to review the applications, consult with appropriate stakeholders. It asks that we actually work with stakeholders affected by the pilot project, develop the approval denial process, review the approval of performance measures and the outcome goals, review and comment on the county implementation plan. We have to ensure there's no violation of rights, procedural rights that is in the language, and also make sure that we haven't violated any state federal plan agreements. We have to review modifications of the plans, monitor the plans, and then work with the counties on the process for cancellation of the projects. In one scope, you know that the projects are between 12 months and 3 years, so there's also a process by which the counties can stop any point in that time, and the state agency has to be assured that any rights of any individuals affected by that are returned back to the original state before the pilot project. So we see that as taking effort and time, and given we don't know the scope of the pilot projects and up to 10 per agency, that's our concern.
Madam Chair, to Senator Ingebrigtsen's point, I think it's maybe easy to mix the authority that they're seeking in Article 1 with the pilot projects in Article 2, because I think the authority in Article 1 allows them to go forward on their own. They're not going to have to submit a pilot project to do that. But there are things that are connected with current agencies that they feel that they could do in a better way, that is what's represented in the notion of applying for pilot projects and trying to prove their point.
Right, and with federal money involved, they understand that that may come with strings attached that someone has to have oversight over as well.
Madam Chair, if I may, that's where we'd be assuring. Sometimes federal law requires that there be a choice of vendor, for example, in certain situations, or that all citizens within the state receiving that benefit have the same eligibility and access to those benefits. So we just have to make those assurances in the process.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Carlson, I wouldn't want to see any of these projects, you know, have so much oversight that they don't have a chance to be creative. But at the same time, we have to remember that we are cutting budgets significantly. No matter whose budget we end up with, there's going to be some serious cuts in state government, and that'll mean a lot of layoffs. So if we're giving them new work, and we're not just giving them new work in this case, you know, we're giving them new work in a lot of cases. So just so we know that if we really want this project to work, we probably should have somebody that can do oversight. And I wouldn't want it to be somebody that was setting up all kinds of rules, but at least just letting the counties know what federal law is on money and state law is on, you know, any expenditures that we have and matching funds and that kind of thing, just to make sure that we don't lose any federal money or whatever in a project, and to kind of look at the legality of it, but not look at how they can tighten it up and prevent a project, because that won't work. So I wouldn't want to see a lot of rules made around this, or, you know, rules, agency rules or anything, but just to help. So I don't know that we wouldn't need a staff person, and you know, I don't know either that we can utilize the staff and state agencies that we'll have left. There's been 11% reduction in state agency staff in the last couple of years, and there'll be more than that upcoming in the next biennium. So just a thought, you know. Don't know that we want to X out and put more and more on the work we have to do in the state.
Of course, maybe once the counties take over some more of these.
Yeah, then it's a different case.
Yeah, I mean, if some of this work reverts back to the counties and the state has to have less mm-hmm. oversight, that could eventually occur too, I imagine, once they get rolling. So is there a motion for Senate file 1340?
Sure.
Senator Higgins, is there anybody in the audience who wanted to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Higgins moves that Senate file 1340 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Madam Chair, I'd like to give a special thanks to your staff. And Amy and Mr. Bodden have been extremely helpful, and I want to thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you, members.
We do have good staff, and we'd just like to acknowledge them in case this is our last meeting. But with that, this meeting is adjourned.
Is there, are we under call? Does anybody?